tonight on Arena. David Heyman on playing Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. And we talk to the writers and director of the film Four Mothers. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena and watch live on rte.ie/arena. Death of a Salesman by Arthur Miller is one of the great American plays. At its centre is Willie Loman, an ageing salesman facing the collapse of his career and strained family relationships with his wife Linda and sons Biff and Happy. Set in the 1940s, the play explores themes of the American dream against the harsh realities of life. The narrative shifts between Loman's present situation and his memories, creating a haunting portrayal of a man caught between hope and despair. A new production of Death of the Salesman arrives at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin on April the 15th, with Scottish actor David Heyman playing Loman. Heyman is well known to Irish audiences for his role as Chief Superintendent Michael Walker in the long-running crime thriller Trial and Retribution, and films such as The Tailor of Panama, Ordinary Decent Criminal and The Boy in the Striped Pyjama. I'm joined on the line now by David Heyman, but before I speak to him, here's a short trailer from Heyman's Death of a Salesman.
Call out the name Willie Loman, see what happens. Big shot.
All right, Pop.
Big.
All right.
A star like that can never really fade away.
Pop, I told you, I'm going to retire you for life.
I know he is a fake, and he don't like having people around who know it.
But he is a human being, and a terrible thing is happening to him, so attention must be paid.
I don't see no sense to it. You don't have to go on this way.
Howard, I can't throw myself for my sons. I'm not a cripple. I am not a dime a dozen. I am Willie Loman and you are Biff Loman.
No.
You see what I am. He's in for a shock, that boy.
Look at you. Look at what's become of you.
They don't know me anymore.
Now that's just the thing, Willie.
Sometimes, Willie, it's better for a man just to walk away.
But if he can't walk away...
I guess that's when it's tough.
David Heyman there as Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman, coming to the Gaiety Theatre. And I'm delighted to be talking to David Heyman. David, you're so welcome on Arena.
Oh, thank you, Kate. It's lovely to be talking to you, and I'm really excited about coming to Dublin. I can't tell you, we all are.
Now, it was an Irish play that really was the roots of this production of Death of a Salesman. You and Andy Arnold were talking on David, you were working on David Ireland's Cypress Avenue when you
thought... Yes, we were. One of the best new plays I think I've read in a lifetime. Stunning, stunning piece of work and vitally important. And we sold out the theatre in Glasgow to a rapturous response. It's a stunning play. It's absolutely, it's shocking, it's thought-provoking, it's intriguing. It's a wonderful piece.
Yeah,
he's a very clever writer.
Talk about Willie Loman. Playing that character of Eric is something else.
Yes, I guess I have to climb a mountain every evening, every performance. It's a wonderful, great role. He switches from moments of high elation. We switched to flashbacks, to his fantasies, and he's suffering from dementia. We didn't really understand very much about dementia when the play was written in 1949, but we do understand a lot more. So he's losing his marbles in a very, very dramatic way. And it's the last 24 hours in his life. He's been trying to kill himself, trying to drive his car off the road so that he can leave £20,000 of his insurance money to his eldest son, Biff, so that he can have the life that Willie only ever dreamed of.
After doing such a kind of groundbreaking but modern play like Cypress Avenue, what was it between you and the director, Andy Arnold, that you thought, let's do a classic, let's do a big one?
Well, both of us, Andy and I, worked really well together. And when Trafalgar Entertainment came to us and said, what do you want to do next? We both leapt on the idea of doing an American classic. And then in both our minds, the greatest American classic is Death of a Salesman. It is still so relevant today. Normally you get, you know, when you've got a tragedy, it's about kings and queens and tyrants and despots. This is about an ordinary working man. He's a salesman. He drives hundreds of miles up and down the coast of New England selling his wares, and he's a disaster. He's gone beyond the point all his previous colleagues have died or have retired, and he's a man out of his time, and he fails miserably. So he has to borrow money from his close friend Charlie, whom he treats like garbage. But they still have an underlying friendship there, and that's his survival. But at the end of the day, he is trying to do away with his life because he thinks his life has been a failure.
Yes, because that whole role of being a salesman, we're in wartime America, post-war America, and it's, you know, it's all about being number one. But as you say, all his clients have fallen away, all his contacts have fallen away, and he's just left now with you know, driving up and around the country, but with nothing to do.
He's left with his dreams and his fantasies that he imposes on his son with great expectations. And all his son wants to do is go off to Texas and look after cattle and ride horses and be in the sunshine and the fresh air. He doesn't want that slog of a life, that where you commit yourself to the man, to the company, to selling. He wants something more than that. So it's a clash of, in a sense, it's a clash of cultures and a generational clash.
Right, you see Biff as somebody, the son that he so adores, that he's a young man and doesn't want the drudgery that his father suffered.
Yes, and the thing is, Arthur Miller described, he said it's not so much about the American dream. He said it's a love story between a father and a son. And that's quite special. It really is. And I have three sons myself, and it makes you reflect on how you've been as a parent. And I've had many people, we've had a wonderful reception everywhere we've been. We've played Glasgow and Birmingham and Edinburgh and Crewe. We're now in Cardiff. Next week we go to Southend and then we come to Dublin. The audiences have had a thunderous reaction to it, really, really moved by it. We've had standing ovations. And so many people meet me outside the stage door and say, thank you, you've made me think again about how I've handled my family, how I've brought up my children, and I'm going to go back and heal all the wounds that I have created in my life. And that's the power of theatre, Kate. It really is. It can make you change your mind, change your life course.
Yes, because you see that he has made so many mistakes, and he hasn't kind of either confided in his wife or confided in his children. And now he's at the end of his career and at the end of the line. And he just sees what a mess he's made of everything, even though his family and so many people love and adore him.
Arthur Miller once said, everyone in the play loves Willie, except for Willie. He doesn't love himself. He doesn't have self-respect for himself, apart from in his dreams and his fantasies and his deranged mind. Because he genuinely is losing it with his dementia. It's hitting him pretty hard.
And David, what's your Willie Loman like? Is he angry?
Oh,
you'll have to
come and see it. I think what's lovely is that doing it now, you know, in the 21st century, We can bring different depths to it because we understand much more now about dementia and you know, the elderly people beginning to lose grasp on their life. And that's wonderful. I think we bring a richness out of it and a depth to it that perhaps hasn't seen before. Certainly a psychological and emotional depth. It's high emotion. It's almost like an opera.
Yes, because it's on a number of timelines, isn't it? There's the present, then there's the near present, and then he has this kind of fantasy life where he imagines talking to people who are dead. And is he, like you're saying there, is it dementia, or is it, some people say he has bipolar, because sometimes he can be quite high and sometimes he can be very depressed.
I think that's spot on, Kate. I think he is bipolar and suffering from dementia. It's a combination of both. Yes, he does live in his family. I mean, his reality is his fantasy life, where he thinks he's a huge success. And he's known all over New England. And he thinks hundreds of buyers and salesmen are going to come to his funeral once he's managed to kill himself. They don't. No one turns up. It's his family and his very close friend, and that's it. So it's really sad at the end. He's living in a complete fantasy of his own making. Of his own need, he had to create this fantasy world to keep himself alive, to keep himself going.
Yes, I think Arthur Miller said about it as well, that he was going to call it, was it Inside His Head?
It was. And there was one set that was designed way in the early days. It was like a huge skull, which was really a house. And the people, the family lived inside this skull, which was very brutal. I mean, ours is very, very much a stripped back version of that. But yes, it was called Inside His Head, and I think he was advised to change it. Can you imagine hundreds of people, thousands of people turning up to see a play called Inside His Head. But it is, in fact.
Now, what is different from, you know, the production? I mean, we've probably seen film productions of Death of a Salesman, or we've seen it in the theatre. Can you describe what's the production like for your version? Or is that another secret, David?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, we strip it back. All the actors are on stage all the time. We have live musicians. We have some of our musicians play several times of strict string instruments. We have somebody plays a flute and somebody plays a violin. And they create a beautiful kind of soundtrack to the play, to the emotional journey of Willie. And they're there on stage the whole time and just sitting at the sides watching. It's almost like they're part of the audience, but yet part of the action as well.
Joining you on stage then is a fantastic cast. Can you tell us some of those?
Well, we've got a terrific cast. We really have, and they're all Scottish actors, which is wonderful. It's a great opportunity for a Scottish cast to tackle an American classic. And every single one of them turns up trumps. Even the smaller parts are beautifully drawn. All these cameos throughout, and we've got a cast of 12, and every single one of them is superb. You know, we're really proud of the production, and certainly so far it's been a huge success, which is terrific.
Now, we know you from the screen, but you have been a theatre actor all your life. Like, you've worked with the Citizens Theatre, you've done Shakespeare, you've done all the great European works.
I've been very lucky, Kate, yes. I mean, I've played Hamlet twice, I've played Lady Macbeth, I've played Troilus and Troilus and Cressida, Nijinsky, King Lear. You know, great roles. I've been very, very lucky indeed. But I have to say, this is one. I mean, it's almost like a King Lear. This is one of the great challenges I've had in my life. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yes, I think you were saying that it is like one of those great tragedies. But the interesting thing about it for the audience is that it's the tragedy of an ordinary person.
Yes, it is. I think the audience identify with him. They identify with his dilemmas, his tragedies, his weaknesses, his failings, the way he treats his wife. He loves her dearly, but yet at the same time he's having an affair with the woman in Boston, which his son discovers, and that's part of the crack-up of the whole family. I mean, he regards me as a snake, as a failure. So, yes, it's great. It's got a huge range. Willie has a huge range. The whole play does.
How would you contrast what you do, film acting, with theatre acting? Do you see a huge difference?
There's a massive difference, Kate. For a start, when you're filming, it's a very technical process. You're a professional actor, you're a working actor. If you get it wrong, you can do another take and you get it right. You're doing it in small, small pieces that someone else, the director, will put it together. You have no control over it whatsoever because television and film belongs to the directors. Theatre belongs to actors. It's like a football team or a sports team. Once you're on stage, the play belongs to you. You lead it. You make the choices every night, depending on the audience. And every audience is different. That's what's wonderful about theatre. It's live. And there's great moments in the theatre when, you sit in a darkened space with hundreds of other strangers and something happens in live time before you, with live, breathing, spitting actors in front of you. And there's that moment of recognition when you suddenly think, wow, that's me up on that stage. Those are my weaknesses, my strengths, my foibles. That's me being cantankerous. And it's a wonderful mirror that you shine on an audience. And I think that's why we've had such a powerful reaction to it. And it's timeless. Although it was written and first performed in 1949, it is still very, very relevant today, if not more relevant, about the wastage of humanity when they're being laid off through the advances in technology. We no longer need the manual work that needs to be done or the administrative work that needs to be done because computers and machines do it for us. So a lot of people will be able to identify in a very strong way.
There's many aspects of Willie Loman's life that are not laudable, and he can be rather, particularly I think to his wife, and he can be very harsh on his sons. Do you get that reaction from the audience as well, who don't like elements of your character?
Oh, we're aware of intakes of breath. Especially when you've got 1,000 people intaking their breath, it's quite a powerful force coming back on stage at you. Yes, we very definitely hit the mark. But he loves her dearly. He loves everyone in the play, but he doesn't know how to treat them because of his failings and his inadequacies, because he does feel a failure.
As well as your wonderful acting career, both on stage and on screen, you have always been involved in humanitarian works. I think ever since you played Jimmy Boyle in A Sense of Freedom, you have, brought plays to prisons, and you've also got a foundation that helps all over the world, including Afghanistan and Palestine. How did you get into that work, David?
I was very lucky. I was born of a mother who was an angel barely disguised as a human being. Her only language was the language of love. She always took the underdog's part. She always looked after people that are less fortunate than ourselves. And we never had money as a family, never had money at all. But my mother always had such a huge heart. With her as a role model, I couldn't do anything else. So in, I think it was 2000, I set up Spirit Aid, a celebration of human spirit. And my first project was Afghanistan. We'd bombed Afghanistan to rubble after 9/11. And I felt it was so unjust. The people of Afghanistan didn't take down the Twin Towers at all. And this is one of the poorest countries in the world. And I was shocked by what I saw. So what I did was I created the first two mobile clinics in Central Asia that covered aspects of the Hindu Kush in northern Afghanistan. And we looked after isolated villages and women's groups and refugee camps. And then it spread from there to Palestine, where we've been supporting the training of Palestinian nurses. We've been bringing them to Scotland for extra special training, extracurricular training, certification, and supporting a refugee camp in Bethlehem. We feed 2,000 children a day in Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world. And it's a bush high school. And when, I sat down with the 10 chiefs of the 10 villages and said, how can we, in partnership with you, help you raise the well-being of the community? And they said, feed our high school kids, because they tended to leave high school and go and work in the tea and coffee plantations as slave labor. So we fed them a lunch. Within about 5 weeks, the school numbers went from 200 to 500. The kids kept coming, started to come back to school. Within 3 years, the pass marks have gone from 12% to 96%. It's one of the highest achieving schools in Malawi. Our graduates are now teachers, nurses, midwives, accountants, police and army officers, lab technicians. You name it, it's transformed a community of 10,000 people in the middle of the African bush. And I'm absolutely thrilled at what we've achieved. And that costs about £15 per child per year. And we've built a school extension. We've got women's training workshops. We've got in every village, we've got a preschool nursery where kids get a preschool education and a bowl of porridge. And then the high school kids that we feed a proper meal to. Food makes all the difference, Kate. If you have a full belly, your brain works.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about that charity, which is called Spirit Aid. And David Heyman, we're looking forward to you being in Dublin so much with Death of a Salesman.
I'm really looking forward to coming, Kate. I really am.
Death of a Salesman will be at the Gaiety Theatre from the 15th to the 19th of April 2025. More information from gaietytheatre.ie. In Four Mothers, the new feature film from brothers Darren and Colin Thornton, a novelist called Edward is live-in carer to his elderly mother, Alma, whose only means of communication is through an iPad. Edward, played by James McArdle, is on the cusp of a major literary success with a book tour in the offing. But when his cadre of friends, who are also gay men and are also minding their own mothers, dump their mammies on him so they can take off to Spain for a pride holiday, Edward has to juggle his people-pleasing tendencies, his literary ambitions, and his friendship with his own mother, played wonderfully by Fionnuala Flanagan. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by Darren and Colin Thornton, who co-wrote the film. Have you always co-written? This isn't your first project. You did A Date for Mad Mary together.
We did A Date for Mad Mary together, yeah. No, we've been pretty much, yeah, for the last sort of 15 or so years, we've been we've done everything together, yeah.
Oh, right. And when did you decide, you know, to not be writing separately and to write together?
Probably 2004, 2005. I think Colin had gone to drama college for a while, and then he was going to act. And then at a certain point, sort of, you veered more towards writing then, and which was great for me. It was, you know, music to my ears, because I sort of liked sort of writing in partnership with other people. And then it was very simple when we worked together. We've a very shared sense of taste. So the
and
process
Colin, were
became
you both
easy.
Film buffs?
Yeah, we've always been film buffs. I mean, from as far back as I can remember, Darren always had a video camera and was, you know, trying to make little short films and stuff like that. And even with our parents, you know, from as far back as I can remember, we were always going to the cinema together as a family.
Now, it's interesting that you talk about your parents there, because your mother is very important in the creation of Four Mothers. So the project is based on an Italian film, Darren, and then you'll tell me where your mum comes in.
So probably around about 2016, our first film, A Date for Mad Mary, had come out, and we were kind of in the middle of promoting that when we got word that mum was unwell and that she had a degenerative disease and was going to need care, and so me and Colin sort of alternate staying back at home with her along with my mum's sister just to take care of her, because she was going to need sort of full-time care at that point. And at the same time that we were spending all that time with mum as her carer and stuff, we got this DVD in the post from an English producer who had seen our first film, a guy called Jack Sidey, and the film was called Mid-August Lunch. It's an incredible Italian film by a filmmaker called Gianni De Gregoria. And it had sat around, like, we had been so distracted with, you know, just the taking care of mum and everything else at that point, that we'd forgotten about it. And then one day Colin was over in the house and he's like, oh, what's this? And I was like, oh, it's that film that we keep meaning to watch. And we started watching it, and the opening scene was a middle-aged man with his elderly mother who he was a carer for, and he was sort of sat in bed reading her
Count of Monte Cristo.
And it was this really, really funny scene, and we just thought, oh, this is great. I mean, this is exactly sort of in many ways what we're kind of going through right now. We should really try and take this on. And so we talked to Jack about, we didn't want to do a completely faithful adaptation of the Italian film, because it's such a perfect thing the way it was. We thought, well, look, if we take, you know, the Italian version as a springboard and then spin off in our own direction and bring our own experiences to it, we could do something really interesting. And luckily they agreed and they let us go for it.
Now, Colin, you didn't start writing it until after your mother passed away. That must have been quite difficult, though, was it?
We were talking about this earlier. In some ways, it was kind of weirdly cathartic, because, you know, we had gone through this very difficult, very intense, very sad period of caring for her. And then it was very private as well, in terms of the caring for her. Like, sometimes a lot of the time Darren would be on his own with her, and then I would, you know, be with her and be on my own with her. And then when we sat down to write the script and we decided that we wanted it to in some ways reflect the experience of caring for her, we started having a lot of conversations around what that experience was like.
For each of us
in a way that we hadn't while we were going through the experience.
And we were working on other scripts at the time, and that weren't related to mothers at all. But we couldn't seem to get anywhere with them. There was this sort of feeling that we needed to write about Mam in that moment, because there was something just needed to be expressed. We were just, I guess, in a state of grief, and really it was an opportunity to sort of come to terms with that, excuse me, in a creative way. Yeah.
Well, let's play a clip from the film, because this is going to bring up other things we can talk about. In this scene, Edward, plays by James McArdle, tries to convince his mother that someone else could mind her for a little while and give him a little break. Fionnuala Flanagan is, of course, his mother.
You know, I was thinking that might be quite nice to go and see Andrew and the girls in London, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, you haven't seen them for ages. The girls are getting big. They'd love to see you. So I was thinking that I could take you over there and then you could stay with them for a few weeks.
It's too hard.
It's not too hard, Mom. Andrew can manage. Okay, you know, show him exactly how you like everything done and we can go through everything with him before we
get... Too much for him with the new baby. Why don't you come and stay too? We could have a nice holiday there.
Well, it's not really a holiday for me, is it?
Why?
Because, well, okay, because what if I want to go and meet a nice man? Can't do that with all yous around, can I? I'm destined to be single forever.
You can meet a nice man on your phone anytime.
Well, I can meet a nice man on my phone anytime. Right, and where would I bring him? Here, well, I'd bring him here. Well, to meet you. Okay. Well, that's not going to work. You'd probably scare him away with your beady eyes.
Fantastic scene there. James McArdle as Edward and Fionnuala Flanagan as Alma, his mother. You must explain the iPad.
The iPad was one of the was probably one of the first things that we want, you know, that we wanted to include in the film, because our mum lost the use of her voice, which was sort of devastating for her and for us at the time, because she was one of the great talkers and just loved chatting and stuff. So that was a really sort of painful thing that happened. And in a way, being able to use it as a device for comedy in the film was, I don't know, it was just, we were getting revenge on this thing that was a pain, you know, that had caused a great deal of pain. And now we were able to use it for as this device within the film. So, yeah. And then I guess the idea of the voice became, somewhere along the line, it became central to the story that we were telling. It also became about, at the time that we were caring for Mum, we were also doing a lot of radio interviews like this to promote for mothers, but we were constantly sort of coming up against our sort of limitations as communicators and stuff like that. You were kind of going, oh, I'm not really actually that adept at doing this. And so we were struggling to find our voice as creative people, or being able to express our creativity in this kind of forum. And so the parallel between the loss of the voice and then the trying to find the voice just became something as a foundation for the story, something really sort of fertile.
Yes, Edward, because Colin, Edward begins to lose his voice. He's got this huge chance, a book tour of America, but they want to make sure he's got the right, whatever, je ne sais quoi, to be able to do the interviews. And of course, he's a bumbling mess. Sometimes his mother interrupts him on his iPad and stuff. But still, he's just losing his voice as well, because he's been alone with her for so long.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I suppose that is, you know, one of the difficult things that can come from being a carer, that oftentimes you're so... you're so isolated, and it becomes so all-consuming that...
Then when you're around people in a social capacity or in a professional capacity, you're kind of trying to remember, oh, how does this work and stuff. Mm. But also, one of the things that was interesting about, do you remember when we spoke to some novelists at the time, just about what their experience of promoting a book was, and they told us about this situation where the publishers will often bring them for lunch and have a conversation with them, but ostensibly what they're trying to do is they're trying to find out, are you safe to let out in public? You know, especially if you've had a success in America and they're going to fly you over there and do the whole book tour thing and stuff like that. They're going to want to know that you're not going to damage the book, the sales of the book and stuff like that. So there's a sort of a pre-screening thing that happens. So we were fascinated by this and thought, well, that's really interesting if Edward has to sort of have that kind of pre-screening process as on the same weekend that he's, you know, charged with caring for these four women. It's going to be incredibly stressful.
Now, the thing that unites the four women that make up the four mothers is that they're all mothers to middle-aged gay sons. And it really does add to the comedy. There's loads of kind of fun cliches there about the gay son minding the mother and then they dying to escape and then they all do a kind of selfish runner. Not suggesting that it would be only gay sons would do that, but it does add to the humour, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, again, it was one of the things that we decided on together very early on. I am a gay man and I, you know, at that time and still have a lot of friends who have had to step into the role of being carers for their own mothers. And I suppose having gone through that experience myself and seen so many friends and even family members having to step into that role, it just felt like it was a story that we were really sort of itching to tell. And also we felt like, you know, everyone's relationship with their mum is complicated in all kinds of ways. But, you know, the relationship that, you know, gay people or queer people have with their parents can be
especially close,
but also, you know, have its fair share of complications as well. So we just thought that that was...
It's also sort of interesting that, like, when we talk to people now who've seen the film, sometimes people who haven't been carers are often like, I just don't understand how people could leave their mothers. That just seems really ridiculous to me. And yet the people who have been carers understand it completely, because when you're in that space where you're a carer, you go so crazy because you have no sort of life beyond the house that, you know, it's people would kind of go, yeah, I can see how two people would just run away from that responsibility. You know, that there is a sort of degree of credibility there was, I think, for a lot of people who haven't experienced that, it does seem, you know, so absurd and over the top.
Yes, they go to a gay pride event
festival,
and
yeah.
They are so happy,
yes,
you know,
they
because
are,
they
yeah.
have kind of, you know, broken
yeah,
free,
free
and
yeah,
they know
yeah.
Edward is going to look after their
yes,
mammy.
Yeah, yeah.
We were actually we were speaking about that earlier, that, you know, some people kind of vilify them and say, you know, that's appalling what they have done. But we were both sort of saying that we actually understand it, just that you know, yearning to be able to just have a break, to be able to just get away for a weekend and live the life that you feel like is
left behind. And
you're leaving. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Then there's the mammies. You have four mammies and you have the wonderful Fionnuala Flanagan as Alma, who is, you know, tough, but oh, so delectable to look at. And her beautiful, smiling countenance is just so lovely. Then you had to get three other mammies to complement them. How did you go? Well, you had it written, obviously, and then you went to cast it. In the writing, did you have role models?
No, I mean, we were fairly open about it and stuff, and we were really lucky. I mean, once we got Fionnuala in place, that was just such a major part of the puzzle, sort of, for us. And Fionnuala is so wonderful to have on something like this, and so great to work with. And then, you know, other people become really curious about the project when somebody of her caliber is attached to it. So, you know, once we had Fionnuala in place, then the rest of the casting fell into place relatively. We were very cautious about it, and we made sure it was during COVID. So we would have made sure that we had all of the four women meet one another and us across Zoom before we kind of made any kind of commitments and stuff, just so that we could see that there was a sort of an easiness and a chemistry there to the four ladies and stuff. But it was good. I mean, it did take a while, I think, but it was, yeah.
So this is Dervla Molloy plays...
The brilliant Dervla Molloy,
plays
yeah.
Jean. Stella McCusker plays Maud and Paddy Glenn plays Rosie.
Yes, yeah.
And actually the first time, as Darren said, when we got to see them over Zoom together, you really could feel the chemistry between all of them, and even just the comedy. It was really electric.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had tried different combinations and stuff like that. But as soon as we saw the four of them together in their four boxes on Zoom, we just knew.
Yeah,
there's a dream cast.
And each of them is very different. They're all very different in terms of how they approach the craft, in wonderful ways. It just, yeah, makes all of the characters sort of pop.
So we've a clip from the bus. So here Alma gets more animated about Edward's personality quirks while all four of the mammies are on the bus together.
Edward, you can't cope.
I can't, ma'am, please. Please stop, please.
I'm sorry to cause you trouble.
No, it's that you didn't mod it. It's fine, it's totally fine.
Who was your meeting supposed to be with?
My publicist. It's about promoting my book in America.
He is very important writer, but gets so nervous before his meetings.
Why do you get nervous?
I don't get nervous.
You should get Dermot to prescribe some anti-anxiety medication. His therapist, my son.
I don't need anti-anxiety medication.
Well, so, I take a half cheeky if I'm flying anywhere and there's not a bother on me then.
But I mean, I get that because if you don't like flying, but I don't need anti-anxiety medication. It's just I don't like having meetings, which is completely normal.
Why?
Because I don't like talking to people. That's, I like being on my own.
Weird.
It's not weird, ma'am.
What was his father like?
Weird.
Ma'am!
You are just like your dad.
I am not. Do not compare me to dad right now, please.
The very same.
The four mammies on the bus there with Edward. Now, obviously, Alma is talking through the iPad, but we get used to it as, I mean, I know you didn't like the iPad because you experienced it, but we as viewers kind of go, oh, yeah, because we see the contrast between her countenance and what she's saying.
Well, that was the appeal of it, because it's so, there's so much sort of feeling and emotion behind Alma, that, and there's so much life there in her, that the idea of having something really as deadening as this device that's her mode of communication is just a really interesting combination of elements. And that's why the casting of Fionnuala was so elemental for us, that we would have someone who had that. And Fionnuala hated the device. I mean, did really didn't like having to use it, did not want to do it, which was, you know, frustrating for her at the time, but brilliant for the film, because all of that came through in the performance and came through in what we were shooting. Like the frustration that she felt towards having to use that was really palpable.
And you made a decision not to use Fionnuala's voice, you know, the way people do now, that they can have a similar voice on the iPad.
Yeah, that was, I mean, I think at the time that we were finishing post, that was just becoming a thing, that people could voice bank their own voices and stuff. But I just, the more sort of deadening that it sounded, the less animated it was, the more compelling and the more absurd the whole scenario became. So it just, had we used Fionnuala's actual voice, I think we would have lost some of that, that sort of weird chemistry between the robotic voice and the emotionality that she was going to bring organically to it as an actor.
How do you feel about the film now, Colin? Do you find it hard to watch?
I don't, because I've seen it so many times. I've sat with it for so long. So, I mean, I found yesterday hard. We had some advanced screenings for Mother's Day, and I had a lot of friends. I had a lot of gay men who took their mums to the cinema, and they took photos and they sent them to me. And that was very moving, but also just, you know, hard. It wasn't lost in me that it's, you know, an experience that I'd love to be able to have with our mum. And unfortunately, you know.
Yes, well, I think you've made a beautiful film.
Thank you.
Darren and Colin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My thanks to Darren and Colin Thornton. Their new film, Four Mothers, opens in cinemas this Friday, April 4th. This year's Architecture Biennale in Venice is focused on the climate crisis and all kinds of solutions. The Biennale curator, Carlo Ratti, has said, to face a burning world, architecture must harness all the intelligence around us. Many of these solutions will involve technology and data, but at the Irish Pavilion, curated by Cotter and Nason's Architects in Cork, it will show off a much more tactile exhibit. Assembly is a multi-sensory installation involving timber, textile, poetry and sound. It's inspired by the innovative political model of the Citizens' Assembly, a circular space to draw people together, a large sound box visitors can walk into and around. Louise Cotter is leading the project, and the architect and poet Michelle Delis is also a collaborator, along with sound artist David Stalling and curator Luke Nassens and woodworker Alan Meredith. Louise Cotter and Michelle Delis join me from our Cork studio. You're both very welcome.
Thank you for inviting us, Kay.
Thanks.
Now, Louise, could you just tell us what the Architectural Biennale is for those of us who may not have been there?
Well, it happens in Venice every 2 years, alternating with the Art Biennale. And it really is the preeminent architectural exhibition in the world, I think. So the way it works is that the curator selects collaborators to create particular exhibitions, but then a number of countries also have their own pavilions. So this year there are 66 countries who will be located in the Arsenale, which is the main centre of the Biennale, or else in the Giardini, which has the large pavilions owned by large countries like the USA and Britain and so on.
Now, Louise, you've been there before.
Yeah, this is I think my third time. It's David Nesson's fourth time at it. So we participated first in 1986. It was quite some time ago that it was curated by Aldo Rossi. And most recently, we were invited to take part in a show called Close Encounters by Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara in the 2018 Free Space Biennale.
That's right, when they curated the Biennale.
They yes. did. And actually, Michelle here also worked with us on that installation as well. But now we're actually representing Ireland, which we're really thrilled about. And we have the chance to, you know, absolutely put our best foot forward.
Absolutely. So Louise, you saw the overall theme, which was climate change.
Yeah.
And then you set about putting your project together, which is this wonderful sound box. So maybe tell us about the idea first and then how it became this concept.
Yeah, well, I suppose the ask was that each country would bring one local solution to create a toolkit for solving the world's problems. It's a very large and broad question. But what we decided to do was to not propose some technological or economic solution. What we looked at, we looked at it from an oblique angle. We can't really depend on architectural or economic or engineering solutions. They must emerge and be tested through conversations with the widest possible public. So all of us have a stake in solving these problems, but if it isn't approached in a collective manner, then these solutions will not be taken on board. So I suppose we were looking at a way to, people need to pool knowledge, exchange ideas, debate proposals for our future. It requires, in other words, assembly. So we were very inspired by the Citizens' Assembly, which is an incredibly innovative democratic process, which takes its time. And this process looks at knotty constitutional problems, as we all know, like marriage equality, biodiversity loss and so on. But by bringing people together, by bringing expert speakers into the room and allowing them to listen to all points of view and then breaking out into smaller groups, there seemed to be uniquely sort of a great feeling of consensus and debate, and huge change was wrought, and it really was very successful. So I suppose what we're looking at is maybe creating a prototype for a form of assembly that could happen in much more local situations like communities, town halls and so on, where our prototype could make the place a place of civic participation.
And Louise, the prototype is a space created from wood.
It's a space created from wood. We were interested in archetypal forms of assembly, all sorts, choir stalls, temples, cattle marts. These spaces generally became, it was the round ones that fascinated us, and the ones that also use sound, like cattle markets, temples where there's music and so on. So we looked at this primeval form, invented it, also looked at the scale of it. I remember Michelle and I were just looking at the, how far did you have to be to still see somebody's eyes and be able to communicate effectively with them? So we're creating this circular form. It's made out of timber, Irish timber. Two beech trees were felled in a storm. So Alan Meredith happily accepted them from the local farmer, saw the timber, seasoned it. Obviously, another theme of the Biennale this year is circularity and sustainability. So the pieces are designed to be very small, light, lean. It's a modular structure. So if needed, and it will be travelling around, of course, it'll be going on an Irish tour as well. So that had to be adopted into it.
So in this structure, which is a circular structure, and I see the reference now to a cattle mart, again, a circular structure, there's a sound dimension. Let's listen to one of them, which is the cattle mart, and we'll just have a listen to this clip. So there we get the idea, like Martin Market long ago. Maybe I'm the only one who'd remember that.
I think everyone remembers that. And in fact, Alan's father is a farmer, and just, you know, this made him so happy to hear this sound.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And that whole idea of the animals going around in the circle being bidded on.
And people clocking each other across the circle as well, the way that they communicate with eyes and gestures. It's all very subtle. I suppose since the COVID pandemic, we just find... we were very fascinated with interesting ways that people assembled and how inventive people were, actually, you know, whether it was under a tree or wherever. It didn't need to be in a structure invented for that purpose, you know.
Absolutely. So, Louise, you're there with Michelle Delis, who is a fellow architect but also a poet. So, Michelle, tell us about your involvement in this project. You've been brought on board as a collaborator.
Yeah, so as Louise mentioned, I was collaborating with Dave and Louise in 2018, so I was really happy that they invited me back on this proposal. My role has been hard to define now, as usual, but ultimately I'm kind of working as a creative producer, but also as a collaborative artist with the sound design itself. And we're trying to, so I'm working closely with David Schelling to provide the verbal elements of the soundscape, but we've also been trying to roll in a lot of the early kind of sub-themes that we've been looking at and trying to see how we can actually integrate those into the overall experience.
Yes, because there's this wonderful wooden structure, and then there's all these various portals where sound comes from. So in one, we'll get the cattle marked. Correct me if I'm wrong. Then in another, this beautiful bird song. And then we get the citizens' assembly and the debate that was going on there. And then your poetry will be another element. Is that right?
Yes. So I suppose we have, David is working with two separate sound compositions, one to fill the exterior of the model and one that will be far more intimate experience and probably more of an experimental sound experience on the interior. So this was really what I was collaborating with him more so on. And I suppose from the early proposals, there was always an idea that there would be a voice within this intimate space. So then there was a question of what should the voice be or what should the voice be saying, and we found it most straightforward to split them between the themes of congregation and construction. So I suppose the interviews with the citizen assemblies, designers and participants would have looked into the congregation element of it, whereas the poetry then, the role of the poetry was to reflect more on the construction and the story of the thing being made.
Yes, because the little section you're going to perform is called Rug. So there is a rug in this wonderful wooden structure. So I guess the poem is to go with that.
There is. Colm and Martina took us in one day. So we were lucky to, I suppose the poetry has to be written on lived experiences, and I think this coincided well with the fact that we were filming the whole process as well. So it was a bit of a directing by day and then reflecting, writing poetry by night. But I felt really lucky to be on site for those fabrications, and I suppose the poem is a way to invite the listener and the visitor into that. So it's in five sections, is my interpretation, beginning with sketch, as always, into trunk, onto timber, and then onto rug, and finally a more abstract verse about the sound. So I'll go ahead and read
the
rug one for you now. Rug. Sliding the shed door latches shuns the winter sun from the carpet maker's canvas. The stump rings project upon his back. His gun, tufting, firing wool, fabricates with a primary Persian palette. The piston jolts the scissor's head to help the needle thread, and the maker trails in circles to cut, to shear, to trim, to snip, stray millimetres from the carpet surface.
Lovely. That's Michelle reading there from Rogue. Now, Louise, obviously people are a vital component of that. You have your wonderful structure, you have your sound components. Presumably you want people to go in and walk on that rug and hear that soundscape within the within the wooden circle.
Yes, it is a multi-sensory experience, and I think the way the structure is designed is that it enhances the sound. The speakers that David Stalling devised, Voigt pipes they're called, they're like musical instruments in that they do amplify the sound in a very particular way. The whole structure works to make the sound rich and interesting, and yes, people are supposed to move around in a circle and experience it. Out around the perimeter, the sounds are just the background sounds of Ireland's environment, natural, social, technical, like there are sounds of traffic, the chant of the cattle market that we heard, hedgerows, and it's a more of a low-key sound. And then obviously the composition, as Michelle has described, is far more composed and particular inside. And, you know, I think this Biennale will be a very data-driven Biennale with, you know, a lot of information on it because of the subject matter.
Yes.
And our room, the Irish Pavilion room, is at the end of a very, very long promenade through all of the spaces. And I think people can get a bit exhausted and overloaded. So it's about creating a quiet space where people can reflect and, you know, imagine their own thoughts and think of their own memories. I think the most successful spaces in architecture have a mystery and don't need to be explicit. We're making a metaphor for a place of assembly, and because we're not forcing people to be interactive with it in Venice, they will simply listen to the sounds, and the sounds are like a Greek chorus that they represent humanity.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful space to visit, and I know people will get a chance to visit it when it comes back to Ireland. Assembly will be on view at the Venice Architectural Biennale from 2025, from the 10th of May to the 23rd of November. Further details on labiennale.org. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields. Paul Murnock was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next after the news.